I'm Sam Zeff, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. It's been named one of the 8 wonders of Kansas, and it only takes one drive there to understand why. Today, we look at the Tallgrass Prairie Reserve in celebration of its 20th anniversary, something that almost didn't happen. We'll find out what it takes to keep the preserve running and how it all started in the first place. Then, we rock chalk our way into the career of legendary KU basketball coach Fog Allen, who led the Jayhawks for 39 seasons. More than his skill at leading young men on the court, it was what he accomplished off the hardwood that made him one of the most influential men in basketball. Also, Brian McTavish brings you the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Okay, so here's the thing about the Kansas Flint Hills. I think it takes a couple of drives through them to really appreciate the beauty. And for me anyway, each time I travel through them, I love them just a little bit more. Today on Up to Date, we're going to appreciate the Flint Hills by celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve. Joining me, Dave Kendall, producer of the Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve documentary. You'll be able to see that soon on KCPT. Dave, thanks for being here.
You bet.
Heather Brown is Chief of Interpretation and Visitor Services at the Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve. She's on the phone from her office at the preserve. Heather, thank you.
Thank you.
And Annie Wilson, Program Coordinator for the Flint Hills Map and Education Program. And she joins us from her home at Five Oaks Ranch in the Flint Hills. Annie, great to have you.
Thanks, Sam.
Heather, do you have a window in your office?
Somewhat. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me what you see as you look out over the Flint Hills this morning.
Well, I'm pointed the wrong direction, but when I come to work every day, I see beautiful, you know, the prairie grasses and the wonderful geology of the Flint Hills. So it's a beautiful place.
Not a bad way to get to work.
No, not at all.
Probably better than my commute. Dave, I want to ask you about, there was a bumpy and pretty contentious road to actually establishing the preserve, and I want to ask you about that in a minute. But Heather, first, tell me why folks need to visit.
Well, I think they just need to visit because it's a very unique place, and I've said it time and time again, there basically is something here for everyone, whether you love the prairie, you know, nature, or you love the cultural side. You know, we have the historic buildings as well. There's just something here for everyone, and it's peaceful, very peaceful.
You know, I think that we could use a little peacefulness in this day and age. Do you not agree?
I agree 110%.
I want to, Dave, it wasn't easy getting the preserve approved, and you spend quite a bit of time in your film covering the politics and the controversy around that. Tell me about that.
Well, it's something that took decades before they finally found a way to work things out to establish the preserve, and so that's a big part of the documentary. It goes back to the 50s when there was something proposed to create one near Tuttle Creek, and that lasted about 5 years, and they ran into a dead end on that because it turned out that not everybody was excited about the idea of creating such a place. It heated up again in the 70s. And it was not until the mid-90s before they worked out a way to resolve the issues. And that's something that Annie Wilson was more involved directly, can talk about what the issue was.
Yeah, I want to get to Annie in just a second, but I just want to explore a little bit more going back to Tuttle Creek. So what you're saying is, so there was a big battle when they wanted to create what is now the Tuttle Creek Reservoir. The Army Corps of Engineers came in, used eminent domain. There was a big battle between people who lived in that valley, produced a pretty famous propaganda film about that. And so what you think is it was that fear of the federal government taking over private land that lapsed over into delaying what is now the preserve down there?
Right. The early proposals involved the use of eminent domain, where the government comes in and basically condemns property and takes over private property for whatever their use is. They just done that for the creation of Tuttle Creek Reservoir, where they displaced a lot of families and communities in the Blue River Valley. Mm-hmm. And that really, you know, was a sore spot for the local communities there. And so when they talked about condemning even more land to create a park around the preserve or around the reservoir, then that really got people, you know, fired up pretty quickly.
Yeah. Annie Wilson, I want you to jump in here. Your grandfather had a ranch on the prairie. You lived there since you were 25, yes?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and you say the initial suggestion of using eminent domain to establish the preserve wasn't popular. We just talked about that. Talk to me about that from a more personal perspective.
Well, my grandfather's place where I lived was in the one of the earlier proposals, and of course it just was horrifying and a nightmare to think that this land that we loved so much and had worked so hard to try to steward correctly and take care of would just be taken away, partly because we had taken good care of it. That was one of the ironies. It was good prairie, and that's where they wanted to take people's land from, people had taken the best care of it. And so it seemed really like something that was just a nightmare we hoped would never happen. And it was a bad start. I always have believed in the need for public access to the prairie, because I think if you want to keep it preserved, you want people to know it's there and understand it and enjoy it. But it seemed like a really horrible way to go about it.
So, Dave, what happened that finally swung it in the direction where there was able to they were able to find legislation and create this preserve? What happened?
Well, they moved away from the concept of condemning land through eminent domain, and through the involvement of people like Senator Nancy Landon Kassebaum, who convened a group of people representing different perspectives on it, they came together and found some ways to work through some of the issues involved with it. And there was a situation presented itself where there was a willing seller, a ranch that was up for sale, and it was not a matter of being condemned by the government, but it was a willing seller situation where the land was available for sale, and that kind of got the ball rolling on, oh, hey, we have a particular piece of property here now, and how can we work this out that is agreeable to everybody?
Mm-hmm. Heather, give our listeners a sense of the scope of the preserve. How big is it?
It's nearly 11,000 acres, and most of that is native tall grass prairie.
You know, you mentioned that there are historic buildings. There's a little something for everybody. So let's just go through that. Tell me about the historic buildings there.
Sure. The preserve, you know, the buildings date from 1878, and Mr. Jones started here in 1878. His idea was to build a cattle feeding station. And so they were, railroad was big, and they had just come into Chase County. And so he and his brothers, they were shipping cattle via the railroad from Colorado out here to the Flint Hills. And so the railroad head was just basically 2 miles down the road from this property. So it was very easy access. They would just offload the cattle and then drive them up the road and put them out to pasture, and so they could go about their business of fattening up, and then off to market they would go again on the railroad. So, you know, you have all these historic buildings dating from the 1880s, and it's a beautiful Second Empire-style historic ranch building. And then you have also, it was built in 1881, and then the barn, which is a massive limestone barn, and it was built in 1882. And so you have all of these just wonderful structures that people want to be inside. And then we also have the little one-room schoolhouse, which is the Lower Fox Creek School, just a mile up the road. And so you have all these wonderful structures, a chicken house and an outhouse and an ice house and a curing house and a scale house and such. So, you know, like I said, there's a cultural side element of this, too. I mean, part of the reason that the park was put aside, of course, was for the tall grass prairie ecosystem, but also for the ranching legacy. And this is basically the end, celebrates the end of the open range, talking about the enclosed holdings. So no longer could you openly graze your cattle out here on the property. The herd laws changed. And so you were, as a landowner, you were required to fence your property. And so Mr. Jones did that. And so here's a really interesting fact, is that his 7,000-acre ranch basically was over 30 miles of stone fence. And the stone fences are about 4 feet tall and about 3 feet wide at the base. And so that is a massive amount of stone, you know. And so you'll see some of those remnants here. We've also did some reconstruction of some of those fences that are here around the historic grounds area. So you can really, you know, kind of appreciate the hard work that went into building this property, and the buildings are just phenomenal. They're beautiful.
I want to throw this out there to anybody, but so it sounds like that part of the Flint Hills has always been sort of the place where there's been cattle and ranching, unlike when you get to the western Kansas, where a lot of that prairie land was plowed under, some would argue led directly to the Dust Bowl. So why is it that that land that is now in this preserve, why wasn't that ever turned into wheat? And it seems to always have been cattle land. Whoever wants to answer that.
Annie.
I think Annie.
Yeah. Annie.
It's actually our ranch. There was a little tiny bit of farming done in the 1880s up on the upland areas. And where that happened and the grass was destroyed, it will be centuries before it goes back. We call it go back land, but there's a lot of soil loss. Of course, growing corn up on those, and it goes right back to the name of the Flint Hills. Well, why wasn't it plowed? Well, there was too much rock and it was hilly, so the Flint Hills. But they did try it a few places and it didn't work out, and we pay the price for a long time because the prairie just doesn't just grow right back. It takes a long time of the succession of plants for that to restore itself. But fortunately, it's kind of like was the Flint and the limestone were kind of like an armor, I think of it, that kept and protected the prairie from the plow.
Annie, you work with something called the Flint Hills Map and Education Program. Tell me about that.
Well, we have designed educational exhibits, including a large map of the Flint Hills that I think for the first time in a public map displays the remaining tall grass prairie. And this was data that we got from the Nature Conservancy. And then we have educational side panels in three levels for elementary, middle, and high school. And we have very recently placed these at no cost. It was all funded by private donations in 184 schools across the Flint Hills of Kansas and even a few in Oklahoma. And our goal is to deepen our students' awareness and understanding of this very special place where they live, which is our idea is in order to preserve a place, you have to understand it and be taught about it and learn to love it. And that's one reason I think the preserve is so important, because it is a place where kids and their families can go and experience the beauty of the prairie and identify those native grasses that we hope that they will all learn and get outside and enjoy this incredible environment that we are blessed with. Last 4%. In North America, here where we live.
Flint Hills and the Tallgrass Prairie extend down into Oklahoma a little bit, but you really can't find what you see in the Flint Hills when you drive through it really anywhere else in the country, can you?
Right, like they said, it's the last 4% of Tallgrass Prairie in the whole world, really.
What happened? I mean, is there, Heather, I want to ask, is there a threat to it? Now, I mean, we're down to 4%. That sounds pretty scary to me. Is there a threat to this remaining prairie, or has the preserve taken care of that?
Well, you know, there's always a possibility of, you know, potential for threats. Some of the, I think, would be fire, and fire is very important for the health of the prairie. And so we're trying to, you know, there should be a good compromise for everybody to be involved, but to make sure that for here at the preserve, we are starting to burn at different times of the year for a couple reasons, but also in the Flint Hills, the majority of the grasses are burned in the spring. And so by the preserve, you know, which is almost 11,000 acres, if we burn at different times, that reduces the amount of smoke that's going north. And so that helps alleviate some of those environmental issues as well. But we're also burning to help rid some of those woody plants that come in and really want to knock back, I mean, especially like the smooth sumac. So if we can burn like late summer when that takes place, that is really the best time to kind of kill that out. So I guess if you were going to say a threat, that would probably be one of the threats that's potentially out there.
Yeah, I mean, the burning is really you're taking over what nature would have done in the past.
Absolutely.
Right. And so it becomes a critical part of preserving it, doesn't it?
It does. It really does. You know, it does need a grazer and it needs fire and it needs someone that, you know, understands and appreciates that. And of course, that takes a lot of people to help with that as well. So it's not just a thing of going out and touching a match to it. There's just a lot of planning and preparing and thought that goes into this. And actually not all of the 11,000 acres ever burns each year. We do different burning and grazing regimes. And so it's a very well thought out scientific method of what we're trying to do here at the preserve and actually, you know, mimic what naturally took place with Mother Nature. You know, not all the prairie burned every year. So that's kind of our thought processes on that.
Yeah, Dave. So you you do this film. It'll be on KCPT at the end of December, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me why now for the film, and what did you discover that you didn't know about the Flint Hills? And I think that's a little bit of a dangerous question because there's probably not much about Kansas you don't know. But I'm curious about what you discovered that that either intrigued you or that surprised you.
Well, first, the timing of it. I mean, this was the centennial of the National Park Service, the National Park System, and the 20th anniversary of the preserve. So it seemed like an opportune time to tell the story of the preserve, our local park system here. And what I learned about it was what she was just talking about was kind of surprising. The Nature Conservancy owns most of the land base there at the preserve, and they have land preservation programs in place and management techniques they have at their disposal. But they've done some studies, and they've determined at this point that something like 50% of the Flint Hills and the eastern portion of the Flint Hills are being taken over by trees. And so that's something that is, you know, a significant concern to some people where, you know, the grasslands get crowded out by cedar trees and that sort of thing. And so that's something that was kind of eye-opening for me.
Yeah. Annie, what is the message that you want to take into schools with your program?
Well, my message is that we've got something wonderful here that we sometimes our kids think that they're kind of, especially rural kids, think they're from nowhere. And we want to help give them the gift of the realization that they are from one of the most beautiful places in the world that people travel from far away to come and see. And we want them to experience the joy and the physical fitness of getting out into the hills and ways to find a way to stay in the Flint Hills in the future, because we do have a lot of economic challenges of ways to find jobs for kids. And we have this sort of paradox. We want economic development, but we don't want it to hurt the landscape. And so we all need to work together to find ways to sustainably keep our population and provide recreation for visitors like at the preserve, and yet also preserve the prairie itself, which is so special.
Yeah. Heather Brown, I understand the Flint Hills are selling like potato latkes at Hanukkah.
They are. It's going great. Our visitation has actually increased by 33% this year. This calendar year, so far, at the end of November, we've had 29,643 people. And I know some of those folks we're not capturing because, you know, people come out and hike after hours, and so we're not clicking them on the clicker. So we're probably losing quite a few people that want to come out and see this special place. So it has been a phenomenal year, everyone working together. And like Dave was saying, the anniversaries, the 100th anniversary of the Park Service and also the 20th anniversary of the preserve. So everything working together, doing more programs and such. But, yeah, we're doing very well for a change. It's great.
That's great news. Great news indeed. We're going to have to leave it there. Dave Kendall is the producer of the Tall Grass Prairie National Preserve documentary. Remind me again when we can see it.
It's going to be on Friday night, December 30th. That's a week from tomorrow night at 7:30 on KCPT.
Heather Brown is Chief of Interpretation and Visitor Services at the Tall Grass Prairie National Preserve. Heather, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Annie Wilson, Program Coordinator for the Flint Hills Map and Education Program, joined us from her home in the Flint Hills. Annie, great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll look at the remarkable career of Fog Allen, the legendary KU basketball coach. I'm Sam Zeff, and this is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And welcome back. I'm Sam Zeff, sitting in for Steve Kraske. Speaking of the Flint Hills, writer Cindy Hodel was in the studio yesterday with an update on her life in that little corner of her world in the Flint Hills. You can catch that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date, or you can download it from the iTunes. On tomorrow's program, some local music watchers with their picks for the best in local music from 2016.
All right, boys, this is going to be the roughest, toughest season a University of Kansas team has ever faced. And to you, Captain Dean Kelly, you're the only returning regular. And you and the rest of these boys have got to carry a terrific load. Do you think you can do it? I think you can do it. What do you think?
Yeah, come on, Fog Allen!
That's the voice of legendary KU basketball coach Fog Allen from some newsreel footage before the 1953 season. Good golly, I think I could go out and beat Missouri after that speech. Fog was not just a great basketball coach. He profoundly changed how the game was played, but a showman and a shameless self-promoter. But Doc, and that's what everybody called him, was a bit of a Renaissance man who wanted his players to become doctors and lawyers rather than professional athletes. Joining me now from the KUOW studios in Seattle is Scott Murrow Johnson, author of the new biography Fog, The Most Influential Man in Basketball. Scott, welcome to Up to Date. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you, Sam. Thanks for having me.
So, Scott, there's a long line of basketball names that some might argue are the most influential. UCLA's John Wooden, North Carolina's Dean Smith, Kentucky's Adolph Rupp, not to mention Wilt Chamberlain or Michael Johnson. Why Doc Allen?
It's funny because pretty much every one of those guys you mentioned has a direct line to Fog Allen. So he was, except for James Naismith, he was before all those guys and had an impact on all of those people. So, James Naismith was the guy who created the game. The easy way to explain it is Fog Allen is the guy who took the game as it was created by James Naismith and took it all the way up to where Wilt Chamberlain was, and that was his last recruit. And then, so pretty much from 1900 to 1950, Fog Allen was responsible for almost everything that happened in the game during that period of time.
You know, when you say everything, explain what that means. I mean, I think you're talking about basketball, the promotion of it. Talk a little bit more about what everything means when you're talking about Doc Allen.
James Naismith created what was supposed to be just a game that was going to be played in gymnasiums like bombardment or tag or something like that. And then it started to become, more and more popular. It kind of caught on for a little while, and Fog Allen and his five brothers enjoyed playing the game. So what he did is he ended up playing at Kansas for James Naismith for a year, and then Fog Allen became the first coach. He decided this can be more than just like a little game. This can actually be a sport where it can be coached, and you can turn it into something where you can make money at universities off this sport. And so he took the game from that point, kind of took off with it, took a few years off to go to osteopathy school. But he was responsible for getting it into the Olympics. He was responsible for, getting all these big arenas built. He was responsible for making it bigger than football at Kansas, at the University of Kansas. He was responsible for, he started the NABC, the National Association of Basketball Coaches, which began the NCAA tournament. So he was partially responsible for that. The first year of the NCAA tournament was a total disaster, and they lost a ton of money. And then he convinced the people who ran it to bring it to Kansas City in year two, promising them that Kansas City was a hotbed of basketball. And I don't think people nationally really understood at the time what a hotbed it was. And he was right. They brought it to Kansas City. University of Kansas ended up making it to the championship game. They sold a bunch of tickets, made a lot of money. And from then on, the NCAA tournament kind of grew into what it is today.
Yeah, I want to talk about that relationship between Doc and James Naismith. But first, tell me a little bit more about Kansas City as a hotbed for basketball. It really goes back to when Doc arranged a game with a team from upstate New York when he was just a teenager.
Yeah, that's kind of where it started. He was the designated free throw shooter, which back in the day was a pretty big deal because only one player could shoot free throws. And, they didn't shoot quite as well as they do now. So most of the points came at the free throw line. So he had this way of shooting it underhanded, and he became known as one of the best shooters in Kansas City. And they had no competition in Kansas City. Him and his brother and a couple of other players at the YMCA there were just rolling over people. And so they were trying to figure out who they could play to really, show how good they were. And there was a team up in Buffalo called the Buffalo Germans at the German YMCA, and they had won the 1904 Olympic Games, which was only U.S. teams, and they had won the AAU tournament. And Fog Allen just wrote a letter to them and said, hey, I will pay your way down here if you guys will come down and challenge my team. And the Germans took them up on it. you know, spoiler alert, but the, you know, Fogg's team ended up beating them. They called it the first world championship of basketball at the time. And then, you know, Kansas City, he sold so many tickets for it that he was able to make the money back and make more money. And that sort of started his career as a promoter. He was only about 19 years old at the time. And so from that point on, people started to realize that if I put a basketball game in Kansas City, it's going to sell tickets. And so the AAU used to send all of its national tournaments to Kansas City, and they used to do, they used to have all these big tournaments in Kansas City. And just researching this, I was really surprised that Kansas City has kind of been forgotten as really a hotbed of basketball and really kind of the place where basketball really blossomed during that part of the century.
A lot of NCAA tournament games played at Municipal Auditorium. The NAIA tournament still played there. I think what surprised me as I read your book, and I think I know quite a bit about Kansas basketball, but the fact that James Naismith was able to arrange this game, turn it into a profitable, and I'm talking about the game with the Buffalo Germans, and make it profitable at the age of 19 was really, I think, quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, Fogg Allen had that in his repertoire. I think, you know, growing up, he had five brothers, and his mother passed away when he was a teenager. Mm. And I think his father apparently took him around to all these carnival circuits and would take him and his brothers around, and they would box people for money to make a little money on the side. And I assume that what happened is Fogg Allen may have just kind of learned, you know, how to be an orator, how to be kind of the Barnum and Bailey type guy, because he had that in his personality, and he was able to use his voice and his power of word just in writing letters to convince the Buffalo Germans to come down to Kansas City and play them. And he was able to convince players to come to Kansas, convince people that didn't think that it would work to, you know, have a basketball game here or to open up an arena here. He had this way about him. He was almost as much a salesman as he was a coach.
Yeah, I mean, that's how he got his, speaking of his voice, that's how he got the nickname Fogg.
Yeah, it sounded like a foghorn when he used to call balls and strikes. So they called him Foghorn and then shortened it to Fog and eventually changed the spelling of it. And that's where Fog comes from.
Yeah. Tell me about the relationship between Doc and James Naismith. Naismith, of course, invented the game and was the first coach at KU. He coached Doc. But it was love-hate may be a little bit too strong, but certainly there was some contentiousness and a little bit of a falling out. Tell me about that relationship. It seemed very complicated when I read your book.
For sure, it was complicated. And I think the easiest way to describe it is that, you know, you might want to say it was kind of two men with different agendas, but it almost seemed like Naismith didn't really have an agenda. He just created this game and he just wanted the game to just be played, and he didn't really have any bigger plans for it. Whereas Fogg Allen, pretty much from the get-go, decided that, wow, this game is so great that I can take it to the masses and I can use this to build up the coffers, the financial coffers of universities and stuff like that. So, you know, Naismith was technically the first coach at the University of Kansas, but he didn't really coach practices. He didn't really, on game days, he just refereed the games between the two teams. So he wasn't a guy that actually went out and did X's and O's. Fogg Allen started doing that at Baker University just down the road from Lawrence. And when he got the offer to come down there and kind of teach the players, James Naismith kind of laughed it off and said, you can't coach basketball. It's not a game you coach. You know, it's like saying, you know, why don't you go coach a game of tag or something like that? But Fogg Allen said, no, there's a lot of ways to coach it, and I can do that. You know, fast forward 20 years when Fogg Allen took over as athletic director, James Naismith didn't want him to be athletic director. He had another guy in mind. He just thought that Fogg Allen was too money-driven. And so during their period together, during those years, the 1920s, right before the Depression hit, there was a lot of butting of heads where Naismith just thought that he was taking this game and really trying to push it too much and make it into this commercial game. And he was even using his own name to sell, you know, Fogg Allen shoes, Fogg Allen basketballs. He encouraged Naismith at one point, said, if you invent a Naismith basketball or a Naismith hoop, you can make thousands of dollars off that. And Naismith just wasn't that kind of guy. So there really was a lot of tension there for about the first 10 years. And then finally in the Depression era, when Fogg Allen offered to help out financially with some of Naismith's troubles. And then when Fogg Allen had that penny campaign to make sure that James Naismith got to go to the first Olympics that included basketball, that's kind of what brought them back together there in the 30s.
You know, the other thing that that I liked about what I discovered about Fog Allen in your book was there's sort of a Zelig quality to his life. Somewhere in every chapter, he's crossing paths with somebody who's famous. He goes to high school with Bess Truman, who wasn't Bess Truman at the time, but would marry, of course, the president. He runs across Casey Stengel and Mickey Mantle, John Wooden as a young man. Did that surprise you to find that that he kept crossing paths with these famous folks?
Oh, completely. Yeah, there was a period when I was done with the book where I actually sat down and wrote down some of these names. You know, Alonzo Stagg was in the book, and Jesse James's son was a part of a scene, and you know, all these people you mentioned. John Wooden had this really random period where he was just driving across the country looking for work, and Fog Allen hired him to help build the football stadium and tried to convince him to play basketball there, and he turned him down. So there's like this there's a little bit of a Forrest Gump quality to his life because he just kept running into these people, and he was so much a part of it. And I think that's why, you know, the first line that I have in the book is Forrest was on the run. And I think that's just because the more I read his story and the more I really understood his story, the more I realized it was kind of like Forrest Gump a little bit, where he just, you know, he was just like cruising through the first half of the century and all these incredible things were happening. The car was invented, plane was invented. There were these amazing things happening, and he was just sort of like right in the middle of all of it. And it really was pretty impressive to see, and it really opened my eyes as to how big he was. And I think because so many things were happening, he was known at the time, but I don't think people look back on that era as like Fog Allen's era, and I think that's why he kind of gets lost in history.
Yeah. So Doc not only has a really profound effect on KU basketball, but really all of KU sports. He creates the KU Relays, which for many years was one of the premier, and still is one of the premier track meets in the country. He dealt with exactly what KU is dealing with now, certainly through most of my lifetime, and that is just an awful football program. So talk to me a little bit about what he meant to the to the athletic department and the growth of the University of Kansas.
Yeah, it's interesting when you bring that up because he went back to Kansas in 1919 as athletic director, and he was almost at the time he was more focused on football at the time, you know, building up the program. 20 years later, when they stripped him of his job as athletic director, it was because he never built the football program up. And as we all know, that just never happened. It's not as easy as it sounds. So while he was there, basketball turned into, you know, this huge thing that everybody knew Kansas for basketball, but he never was able to get the football program up. But, you know, he did build the stadium. He got the Kansas Relays going. I think the biggest thing that he did is he promised to James Naismith, he found a way to take this game of basketball and to turn it into something that could really make money for the university. Through that, he kind of became a spokesman for the university, and I think there were a lot of people in the academic world that weren't real excited about that, especially because his nickname was Doc, and he wasn't technically a doctor because he'd gone to osteopathy school and not medical school. So there was a little bit of tension there. But he really became this sort of at the forefront of the university because he was able to bring in all this money from the relays and from basketball, and he just had an amazing way of kind of a visionary of finding things out there and finding ways to make it use it for the better for the university.
Scott, I think you could argue that one of the most important things Doc did was integrate basketball at Kansas and also in the old Big Seven Conference. He recruited the first black player in the league and then, of course, brought Wilt Chamberlain to Lawrence. Doc and the KU chancellor at the time, Franklin Murphy, really changed the whole city, didn't they?
Yeah, they did kind of they tried to do it, but they did it kind of inadvertently, too. I think Frank Murphy's whole reason for trying to get Wilt Chamberlain to the University of Kansas was because he really saw Wilt Chamberlain as this person. He was an African-American that grew up in sort of a Jewish neighborhood, and so he wasn't really that used to racial tension, and he wasn't, you know, he could come in and he could sort of be the spokesman, and people could look at him, and people that might not there's a color barrier, and they might not want to cross that color barrier. They meet a person like Wilt Chamberlain, and they say, oh, okay, African-Americans aren't that bad. And so I think Frank Murphy saw him as the spokesman that could kind of ease the racial tensions. Fog Allen, of course, saw him pretty much for one reason. He saw him as the guy who could really just take Kansas basketball to the next level. And so when he was recruiting him, He got Frank Murphy and a guy named Dowdell Davis and a couple other people that were these African-American leaders in the Kansas City community, and he had them go out to Philadelphia, and they pretty much sold Wilt on the idea that Lawrence, Kansas has no racial tension. Even around Kansas City, there's no racial tension. It's just everybody gets along and whatever. Well, it was only partially true. It wasn't like the Deep South, but it wasn't quite like it is today. And so when Wilt Chamberlain was driving for the first time to the University of Kansas, he stopped outside of Kansas City at a diner and was told that he wasn't allowed to come in because they didn't serve his kind. And, of course, that didn't go over very well. He almost went back to Philadelphia. But, yeah, it was a very complicated history for Fogg Allen. You know, he was kind of a product of the times. His race relations kind of went up and down. And there were periods where it seemed like he kind of understood, like you said, he was one of the first people to have an African-American into the Big Seven conference. But then there were times before that where he was kind of reticent to let them swim in the pool. And so he really, you know, it seemed like he came around a little bit, but by the time Wilt Chamberlain came around, he didn't care if he was purple, green, blue, whatever. He just wanted the number one guy in the country, and he was going to do anything to get him.
Is it fair to say that Fogg Allen, while not a civil rights firebrand, certainly did things that pushed the ball forward in Lawrence, Kansas? He sort of unexpectedly changed how Lawrence looked at African Americans.
Yeah, I think the Wilt Chamberlain thing, what ended up happening was Fogg's son, Mitt Allen, went around to all the businesses and said, you're going to let this guy in. We're not going to have any more racial tension with Wilt Chamberlain especially, but any of the basketball players. And I think that just sort of resonated. And I think during the 50s, there was a little bit of easing because of that, because Fogg Allen was such a huge figure that when his son went around and said, hey, let's ease off on some of these rules, and it helped out. It also helped that Wilt Chamberlain just became the biggest celebrity. He passed Fogg Allen very quickly, because when Wilt Chamberlain came in, Fogg Allen was put into retirement, and suddenly Wilt Chamberlain became not only the most visible person in Lawrence, Kansas, but the most visible basketball player of all time. And so I think that helped a little bit. Suddenly there was a face of somebody that, you know, white people felt like they knew this guy, and they felt comfortable around him, and they rooted for him. And so instead of it being like this black-white thing, suddenly they felt like, hey, this guy's one of us. And so I think Wilt Chamberlain, you know, through Fogg Allen recruiting him, kind of eased those tensions, kind of like Frank Murphy saw it happening.
Yeah, you know, long before Twitter, social media, ESPN, Wilt Chamberlain was really a pretty famous as he came in to play basketball at the University of Kansas, correct?
Yeah, and the recruiting was interesting because today, you know, everybody knows about the number one recruit in the country. They know him by name, you know, when these guys are juniors in high school. But Wilt Chamberlain, the way that Fogg found out about him is he had an All-American player named B.H. Born at Kansas, who had just been named the most outstanding player of the NCAA tournament. And B.H. Born went to the Catskill Mountains after he was done to play some basketball tournament. And he had a 16-year-old kid named Wilt Chamberlain guarding him, and Chamberlain dominated him. And B.H. Born came back to Lawrence, and the first thing he said is, you got to get your hands on this guy. This is the best player I've ever seen. And, of course, by the time Fogg Allen started recruiting him, everybody in the country had heard of him by that point. But, you know, it was a whole different recruiting scene back then. You couldn't just, you know, get on the internet and have a list of the top 100 guys. There were guys, you know, Clyde LaVellette was another example a few years before Wilt Chamberlain. And he was a guy that was in Indiana, and people kind of knew about him. But by the time, you know, the country really knew who he was, he had already committed to go to Indiana. And so Fogg Allen really had to go in there and kind of make him decommit and make him reconsider and go to Kansas.
Yeah, essentially he stole him on a long drive from Indiana back to Lawrence.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, you really can't forget Doc. You know, the field house is named after him. There's a big old statue out there of Doc Allen out in front of the field house. But it seems that some of his accomplishments are a bit lost, and I'm wondering why you think that is.
You know, I think definitely in Kansas, he's still appreciated at the University of Kansas. Like you said, there's a statue. They know the Allen Fieldhouse. But in researching the book, what I realized is he's not just a Kansas basketball coach. That's what I saw him as. I kind of knew his name. I knew a little bit about him. I knew that, you know, that Adolph Rupp had played for him and then broke his record for wins. And then Dean Smith, who had played for him, broke his record. So I kind of knew he was one of the best coaches of all time. I knew that he was a big deal at Kansas. But in doing all this research, it really dawned on me that he was much bigger than that. You know, he was, as the title says, the most influential man in basketball. I could make an argument where he's been bigger for the game than James Naismith, the guy who created it. He's been bigger for the game than Michael Jordan. I mean, he took this little tiny game in the early 1900s and took it to this place in 1950 where it was ready to just completely explode on the American scene. So I think that's one thing that has kind of been lost in time. And, you know, part of the reason that's been lost in time is because he grew up in the early part of the 20th century, and so people forget about stuff like that. But a big part of it was so many huge things happened in this society from 1900 to 1950. I mean, I already mentioned that, you know, the car was invented. There were the two world wars while he was coaching. There was the Korean War. There was, you know, there was just these unbelievable things going on that it's pretty easy to figure out why a guy like Fog Allen wouldn't stand out over all these, you know, over Jesse Owens and all these people that were doing these incredible things during that era. So I think it took a few years for somebody to look back and really kind of realize, wow, he was doing all this stuff sort of under the radar. People knew who he was, but there was so much else going on that I think in history he's not really recognized for being that important to the game of basketball.
Scott Morrow Johnson, author of Fog, the Most Influential Man in Basketball, thanks for talking with me. Rock chalk, my friend.
All right, rock chalk, Sam. Thank you.
Well, that music can only mean one thing. KCOR contributor Brian McTavish is here. He follows and writes about pop culture and joins us in this studio each week with ideas for your weekend. Brian, welcome, my friend.
That's all it could mean is me, that music, right?
What do you got for me?
Hey, what do we got? Well, we're going to have some heavy duty. Oh, hit it. Boy, that's some good stuff from Radke. Three hard rocking brothers from St. Joseph Mo, 10 o'clock. Sunday night, Christmas night, at the Record Bar. Are you a fan of the hard, super hard rock, Sam?
Well, I am when you are in the room.
Well, I'm in the room, so let's go. We have lively lead vocalist and guitar slinger D. Radke, true bass maniac Isaiah Radke, and do not get in my way drummer Solomon Radke. They're trying to turn the family name into kind of a catchphrase for cacophony, I think. They've made a name for themselves since 2011. They've toured a big swaths of North America as well as Europe. They've also, and this is cool to me, I'm, you know, like that British music, right? So you've heard of New Musical Express, NME, mm-hmm. the famous, the legendary music scene mag over the pond. They've actually found a way over in recent years to get into that thing. They had a feature article in the print edition. It's nice to know they still have a print edition of NME. Anyway, if you're into original metal, you will exult. You might even get exhausted, probably both. You will definitely get an encore when Radke, these three great brothers, go at it. Also on the bill, I do not make these names up, Sam. Also on the bill, Drop a Grand and Stiff Middle Fingers, Sunday, 10 o'clock, Record Bar, rock on.
Yeah, you need to stiff middle finger. I think we... we
fingers,
need to, yeah, we
plural.
Need to, yeah, we need to warn the kids about that.
Well, I'll take this wood and I'll carve me a man, one with a perfect smile and perfect hands. His voice will be yours, but he won't be you. He'll be something better.
That is nice. I mean, that's the kind of sound, that's the kind of singer-songwriter thing that makes me think, even me think I could maybe do that. You know, if I just thought it, if I just got into a room with the guitar, of course, I don't know how to play guitar. Yes. But I mean, I played the trombone. This kind of thing was always very elusive to me, to be that introspective and that imaginative and that original. But that's what Una Walkenhorst is, Sam. This is what the gal is. She's a very thoughtful singer-songwriter. And yes, if that name rings a bell, Walkenhorst, she is indeed the daughter of a certain rainmaker, actually Bob Walkenhorst. And she puts on a compelling show with just her voice and an acoustic guitar, very pleasant melodies, penetrating lyrics, unexpectedly ethereal. I mean, not that she would sound like her old man, right? But she does not. He's great, but she has this very kind of dreamy quality. Her debut album came out a year or two ago. It's called Scars. So she gets down below the surface, of course. I don't know if Una's dad is going to be at this show Friday at 6 o'clock, free early show Friday, 6 o'clock at the Record Bar, but he'll certainly be there in spirit because that's how family works, right?
I think that's exactly how
it works. He's inside of her. That's exactly how it works.
That's how it works?
That's precisely how it works. And if, like I say, it's a free gig, and you know, if you're out and about, check it out at the Record Bar downtown Friday night.
I do just want to say that I think I'd rather hear her than you play the trombone. Don't take that the wrong way.
I just took it the wrong way.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I did.
Just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour.
We are evolving. We are evolving, but so is animal life on this fine planet as we try to protect it as best we can. Biodiversity, that's what it's all about, and we're trying to maintain that. And in that effort is the exhibit, the traveling exhibit, Amazing Species, Life at the Limits. It's a touring exhibit from the American Museum of Natural History. It's all day. Today and Friday, and from 10 to 2 on Saturday at the museum at Prairie Fire. Have you been out there around 135th and Metcalf, give or take?
I have. I don't get that far south very often, but I have been to the Prairie Fire Museum, and I can certainly recommend it, especially for the kids.
Well, hear that, listeners? We both recommend it, so you should be there as we speak. Anyway, for Amazing Species, Life at the Limits, they have all sorts of things, animals of every shape, size, and description, including a climbable Hercules beetle. Do you recall, Sam, you look like you're almost as long in the tooth as me. Do you remember when it was enough of a thrill to go to the supermarket and put a dime in the horsey and rock back and forth? Now these kids today, they get to climb on a gigantic beetle.
And it doesn't, you don't even have to put money in it.
Well, at the door, I suppose.
Well, at the doors.
Okay, have fun out there. Yeah.
And you're up in a ballerina.
Well, you know, I have been looking for a reason to rock out on the New York Dolls for the longest time, and I found it. I found it. A personality crisis? Well, I think that they may be having one with Application Pending. That's the one-woman stage comedy. Have you heard of this show, Sam?
I have not.
Starring.
That's why we have you, my friend.
Well, there you are. See, I guess I set myself up for that one. Okay, it stars Kansas City established and wonderful Kansas City actress Jennifer Mays. She tackles, I want to say, 42, maybe 42 and a half characters in this show. And the setup is she is this, like, totally besieged kindergarten admissions officer at a super Tony New York City prep school. And anyone who's anyone wants to get their precious little Billy or Susie in the school, right? And, well, everybody can't get in the classroom, right? So, you know, Christine is the character's name, is played by Jennifer, and she goes nuts trying to fend off these people, and she acts nuts being these people, dozens of characters. It's a tour de force, so don't even have to force yourself to see the show, and you will laugh easily. Check it out. All right, ready? We may have saved, in some sense, the best for last. It's the ugly sweater party. Not really. It sort of is, but it's really an excuse for the David Hasselhoff on Acid reunion show. Sure, wear your ugly sweater, but we are going to crank it up. Kansas City's progressive rock band goes nuts again for the first time in a long time. And yes, David Hasselhoff says he's a fan. I've read this in print, actually online. 8 o'clock show, Friday night. At the Riot Room, Hasselhoff related to The Guardian recently, actually, that his lawyers found out about this crazy band, David Hasselhoff on acid, and they said, this is awful, this is horrible. Hasselhoff said, this is fantastic. And they are fantastic. So go lose your mind with, if it hasn't already been lost, with David Hasselhoff on acid this weekend.
This is exactly the
it's
way
happening.
I want to. This is exactly the way I want to end a show about the Tallgrass Prairie and Fog Allen.
Yeah.
David Hasselhoff on acid.
Yes.
Be sure to see Brian's six family things to do in Kansas City this weekend at kcur.org. Always a slice of heaven, my friend, to have you right here.
Oh, let's eat the whole pie next time. Come on.
The whole pie.
Come on.
You can listen to previous programs and download our podcast at kcur.org/up-to-date. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. I am at Sam Zeff. Tomorrow we get the weekend started right. We'll be playing the best of local music from 2016. Program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Sam Zeff. You're up to date.